The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Are you longing for a place where hope, ideas, and new ways of thinking can arise? For nearly 50 years, Omega Institute's campus in Rhinebeck, New York, has been a gathering place where world-class teachers provide innovative educational experiences that cultivate extraordinary potential in us all. Join us, either on campus or online. To learn more, visit eomega.org.
Support for this show comes from the National Wellness Institute, committed to providing the tools, trainings, and resources to propel your career in wellness. Become a member today at nationalwellness.org.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, this is Essential Conversations. Our guest today is Dr. Samuel Harrington. A graduate of Harvard College and the University of Wisconsin Medical School, Dr. Harrington practiced internal medicine and gastroenterology for more than 30 years in Washington, D.C. There he served on the board of trustees of the Sibley Memorial Hospital, a member of the Johns Hopkins Health System, and the former hospice care of D.C. His new book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. You can read a review of the book in the March-April issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Dr. Harrington, thank you very much for speaking with us on Essential Conversations.
Rami, thank you very much for having me. Please call me Sam.
I will do that, Sam. Thank you. You can call me Rabbi Dr. Rami Shapiro. No, just kidding. I'm just teasing. So I said to you before we even started that this was a very refreshing book because it's so honest. So if you can turn to the introduction, page, Roman numeral 13, XIII, and read for us the little paragraph that starts, this is a book about exit strategies.
Okay. This is a book about exit strategies. It is indeed another end-of-life book. It is not about making the end of life good. It is about making the end of life less bad. It is not about extending life. It is not even about extending high quality life. It is about avoiding a painful dying process and futile medical care. It is not a philosophical treatise about what makes life worth living. It is simply a practical look at declining health, old age, progressive debility, and practical choices that people can make to minimize the likelihood of the unconsidered death and to maximize the likelihood of a better death.
Okay, thank you very much for that. It's such an uplifting thing, you know?
I like to think of it as empowering. And when I refer to the unconsidered death, I think I subsequently refer to that, or previously, as a medicalized death, a death that is where violent technology, meaning breathing machines and other forms of advanced technology, are used when a patient might have not chosen that exit mode if they had thought about it more.
Yeah, yeah. You give three, I guess, broad categories of death in the book: good, bad, and better. Can you elaborate a little bit on those?
Well, a good death is, a good death, we all have a vision of dying quietly at home after some kind of party and plaudits, and everybody's happy and comfortable and understands what's going on. And that is largely a figment of the imagination. I mean, it does happen, and that is what we strive for. And a bad death I define as in the intensive care unit, and a better death is moving from the intensive care unit toward the good death that I sort of idealized. But if I could take a minute to define a good death sort of on an academic basis, it has been studied, and the attributes of a good death have been condensed to a variety, a small number, and I'll list five. The most important attribute is control, meaning the patient asserts some control over their decision-making. Comfort comes in second, meaning we don't want to be in pain. Closure is third. That's the opportunity to reconcile with family and friends. Affirmation, meaning being appreciated as a patient, having one's values accepted, is the fourth attribute, and trust is the fifth. And those, in my mind, the more of those attributes you can incorporate into the death scene, in a sense, the better the death will be.
Do you think the current system of medicine that we have now encourages those or supports those five things?
Well, I think the current system of medicine moves us away from that toward the medicalized approach, because we have put in place, innocently put in place, systems to improve quality of care in hospitals, but those systems take on a life of their own. Checklists are important for quality outcomes to be improved in a hospital, but when checklists involve moving patients through tests they don't want, or receiving IVs they don't want, or receiving other tests so that they're in the best possible shape for the surgery that's been promoted, these systems take on a life of their own, and patients and the treatment takes on a momentum that patients have a hard time standing up to and saying, please don't do that. I'd rather be left alone, or I hadn't thought this through. Let me rethink it. Let's slow down the process.
What do you think a patient, I mean, what kind of, defendant does a patient need to help out? My dad died a few years ago, and my sister really took on the brunt of saying, of translating his desires to the medical staff. And he was lucky to have her there. My mom was too distressed to do anything, and I think my dad was having a hard time communicating. Is it best to have family members, or is there another way to go about doing it?
No, I think that your sister exemplifies what we all need. When we get old and sick, we are less able to speak for ourselves or to think clearly for ourselves, and we need family members and friends and agents, meaning somebody we've indicated in advance, to speak for us or to help us make decisions. But they also have to be on board with the way we want to make decisions. They have to share our vision of what we want done at the end of our long life. And so it's important to incorporate more than one family member, usually because somebody isn't necessarily going to be available all the time. And that's where multiple conversations come in to spread the word about what we want and why we want it. My father had a vision, which I think is easier to share sometimes than specifically saying, no, I don't want a breathing tube. No, I don't want hemodialysis. Or, yes, I want a breathing tube. Yes, I want a feeding tube. Because a vision is something we can understand and we can use to interpret. You interpret it for other decisions, such as breathing tubes or dialysis or feeding tubes, etc. And my father's vision was to die of a ruptured aneurysm. His vision was to say no to emergency surgery, to say yes to palliative pain medication, and to die within hours. Now, that's a very naive vision, but what it tells me, or told me and my sisters, was that he was looking for an opportunity to die quickly while he was still vigorous and to avoid a long, debilitating illness. So we can use a vision like that to, as family members, to interpret how to make decisions later.
How would we encourage people who are listening, who are maybe either facing this themselves, but certainly even more likely to have elderly parents who are facing this? How do we encourage a loved one to articulate a vision?
Well, I think that family members sort of have a responsibility to interpret a vision. We don't necessarily the vision is more spontaneous, I think. So a family member has to be ready for it. I was sort of stunned when my father was talking about his aneurysm and I was trying to get him to repair it, or at least to do something to strengthen it. And he had pointed his finger at me and clenched his jaw and asked me why he would want to fix something that will carry him away that he wants to go. But other visions, sort of come up spontaneously. For example, you know, when Groucho Marx said he planned to live forever or die trying, well, that's a vision. I mean, and it's a vision that will end up in the intensive care unit. But if that's what he wants and he understands those implications, that's fine. And if somebody else had sort of laughingly said that, a family member, you could question them and say, okay, well, let's talk about that. I was asked in one interview in the past what my vision was. And I said, oh, I really didn't articulate a vision. I wrote this book. And then I realized that I had articulated a vision to my youngest child, who was, let's say, 18 at the time. And she was talking about this, about end-of-life decisions. She was planning to go to college and medical school herself. And I said, well, you know what? When I'm really old and weak, just put 3 trays of food in front of me every day, but do not lift a spoon to my lips or put a straw to my mouth. And I didn't know it at the time, but she remembered that. And that was a vision. And so later on, she reminded me of that and she could use it. I mean, by writing this book and by writing my advanced directives, I've given other directives, but in fact, that vision remains the same, and it'll probably be something she remembers for a long time.
I think that's really powerful. I mean, I have advanced directives also, but the vision idea, I mean, I'd never thought of it, never heard of it before until the book, and I just thought, boy, this is something that people could think about and share with loved ones that would open up to a very deep conversation if they were willing to have it. It also sounds like the loved ones, you know, your dad said what he said and you picked it up as a vision, but the loved ones have got to be, oh, I don't know, paying attention, you know, listening for that vision and not let it just slip by or not just dismiss it as, oh, you know, you're just talking, I'm not listening. So that's a very, very powerful thing.
I'm reminded of another sort of vision that occurred in our family. I was sitting with my in-laws discussing a neighbor who was recently diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, this neurodegenerative disease that's called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis that leads to paralysis, but normal brain function, normal cognition. And one of my in-laws said, oh, as long as one of my in-laws said that he wanted to be kept alive as long as he could read the New York Times and understand it. Mm-hmm. And that is a vision that I immediately latched onto, but the other in-laws sitting with him kind of let it glance off and they ignored it. But that was a real statement on his part. And we have used it for further discussion as a result, because that means he wants to have mechanical ventilation. He wants to have feeding tubes. He wants to have IVs as long as he can read the paper and understand it. And that's, I mean, although my vision is sort of darker, let's say, than some, we have to respect everybody's vision and we have to respect what they want toward the end of life. It may not come to pass, but we have to respect a patient's perspective.
Right. And then thinking, that's certainly true from the doctor-patient point of view, the medical staff and the patient point of view, but also just from within the family to respect that vision. It may not be yours, but to respect the vision of the person. So yeah, this is really very helpful. I know the book is not a philosophical treatise, but I want to ask a couple of questions along those lines based on what you've written. So at one point in the book, you quote, I'm just quoting you, you write, "What makes humans forget that we are not immune to death?" And I've been reading a lot of Seneca lately, and Seneca says you should really think about death all the time. And then you quote Ecclesiastes in the book about the inevitability of death. So how wise do you think it is for us to keep our mortality, you know, uppermost in our heads?
Well, I think it's wise. I don't think it's, I think that without some form of denial, if we walked around saying we're going to die every minute, well, that would be a very difficult way to approach life. So I think we have to try and avoid that kind of grim perspective, but we have to remind ourselves periodically that it is inevitable, and we have to make a plan or have a plan, or at least if we have a plan, if we want to have some control over the process and don't want to just lose ourselves to it. So I think it's wise to recognize that, to recognize it on a regular basis, but not to dwell on it, perhaps, or cloud all our thinking with that.
Yeah, I didn't mean to obsess over it, but that wasn't my idea. But and I didn't get that from the book. But we do tend to ignore it. And you also talk about, again, I'm quoting you, the current generation is obsessed with youth because youth sells. So I get what you're saying, and I'm not disagreeing, but I'm wondering, as millions and millions of baby boomers march, you know, into the grave, I wonder if death will start to sell. I know that I've personally hosted a number of death cafes. You know, that's where people get together once a week for about 8 weeks to discuss the dying process with medical professionals and to talk about afterlife scenarios with spiritual teachers. I've done retreats on dying and death. There seems to be a real interest among people who realize it's closer than they'd like to think. So do you see it shifting at all as boomers get older and older, that maybe the culture will change and we won't be so youth obsessed?
I have not experienced that. I have not seen it. I would hope that there was some kind of refocusing on in that way. But what I have seen, or at least what I have written about in the book as a result of my professional experience, is that boomers have a very high expectation of what medicine can do, largely based on media portrayals, media manipulation, public relations, advances that tell us we're going to cure cancer, the cure for dementia is right around the corner, we have a moonshot for cancer, etc. So I think that baby boomers are enormously influenced by this and feel that they have a much better chance of living, in a sense, forever compared to previous generations. So, and I don't think that they focus nearly enough on the fact that we haven't moved the average life expectancy as much as they think. I'm very interested by what you just said about death cafes. That's a very interesting point, and I would like to, in a sense, see more of that as a reality check, perhaps.
Yeah, death cafe started in Scandinavian area and then came to the United States. I mean, I'm sort of jaded. I think that you know, while there are these things, and I haven't participated in them, I also get a sense that there's going to be a post-death industry where, you know, people who claim to be spiritual but not religious will sort of start taking seminars about, okay, how do I get to the next bardo, or how do I get the next reincarnation to allow the denial of death to continue even when the medical facts are what they are. So there's no end to human delusion, I suppose.
Right. fortunately or unfortunately.
Yeah, which is why the book is so helpful, because you don't get sidetracked by that, and you really do keep us on track. So in the last minute that we have left, I love the idea of vision. I'm just wondering, because throughout the book, you have these very helpful sections called Things to Remember, Things to Consider. So vision was amazingly important. You got one or two other ones that you want to leave us with before we have to bring this to a close?
Think about hospice care as an alternative medical system. Don't think about hospice as going home to die. Think of it as going home to live, and that hospice is protecting you from a medicalized death while treating your symptoms and improving the quality of your life.
Excellent. That is a great way to bring this to close. Vision and hospice, and a lot of compassionate honesty, it sounds like, from the book and just from talking to you for the last few minutes. Our guest today was Dr. Samuel Harrington. His new book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life, is reviewed in the March-April issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. You can learn more about Dr. Harrington's work at his website, samharrington.com. Sam, thanks so much for being with us on Essential Conversations.
Rami, thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. Support for this show comes from the National Wellness Institute, committed to providing the tools, training, and resources to propel your career in wellness. Become a member today at nationalwellness.org. Before we sign off, let me remind you that this year is the 20th anniversary of Spirituality and Health magazine. As part of our celebration, I'm leading an interspiritual tour of the Holy Land. This is part tour, part pilgrimage, as we engage in contemplative practices linked to the various sites we will visit, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and Baha'i. For more information, please visit us at spiritualityhealth.com/holyland-with-Rami. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Please log in to spiritualityhealth.com to subscribe to the magazine in print or digital formats, and to download the iTunes app for this podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a review. Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator and executive producer is Alma Tassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.